Oral argument this morning for our 9 a.m. sitting, People versus Napier and De Herrera v. American Family. Our counsel for both cases here and checked in?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Good. We will be hearing the Napier case first, and then we'll hear arguments in the De Herrera case. Before we begin with the arguments, you should each have received a written copy of the of written instructions detailing the court's procedures for these arguments, but I would like to briefly review them with you to be sure everyone is familiar. First, there will be 15 minutes of oral argument for each side. Second, we do have a digital timing system which shows you exactly how much time you have left in your argument. If appellant wants to save time for rebuttal, you can just close your opening argument when you choose, and then you will have the amount of time for rebuttal that is reflected on the digital clock. We still have our traditional lighting system as well that turns green when you start your argument, yellow when you have 5 minutes left, and red when your time is done. You should be aware that all members of the panel have read the briefs and at least one member of the panel has read the record. For that reason, you may wish to go right to the legal issues in your argument, but of course, how you present your argument is up to you. There is a toggle switch on the podium, which you may use to adjust the height as you choose. Please don't stray from the microphone during your argument because we record the argument. If you stray, the microphone may not pick up everything you say. The arguments are digitally recorded and put onto the court's website and are available to the public. So if there is confidential information you do not want the public to listen to, you may need to exercise caution in including that information in your argument. If anyone in the courtroom has a cell phone or pager, please make sure it's turned off so we don't interrupt us during the oral arguments. We will now hear argument in People versus Napier.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Stinson, attorney registration number 35993. Appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Gary Lynn Napier. The court obviously has reviewed the briefs in this case, and the issue is really fairly simple. Whether or not the trial court below should have made specific findings with respect to denying Mr. Napier's 35B motion. What I'd like to talk to the court specifically about that I think is a little bit outside the brief is a question that Mr. Napier asked me when I met with him. When I went to see him, he said, "Counsel, what could I have done differently to approve this issue?" And he thought about it, and it really bothered me because the only answer that I could give him that would have preserved his 120-day time period in this particular case is, well, you should have assumed that your counsel wasn't going to do her job, and you should have filed a pro se motion. And I think that that's a problem because when somebody has counsel, the whole point of being represented is that an attorney is supposed to be familiar with the rules of evidence, familiar with the proceedings, and familiar with the time frame in this case. Mr. Napier, quite simply, shouldn't lose his basic right because of his attorney's failure to file this.
Let me ask you a question, counsel.
Certainly.
All we have in the record is the attorney's motion. And the attorney's motion doesn't seem to suggest it was her fault that she untimely received this information. So, you know, without any further allegations as to whose fault it was, why would the trial court have thought that ineffective assistance of counsel had been raised in that motion?
And Your Honor, that actually absolutely goes to the heart of the issue. What I would say here is that counsel herself, there's absolutely no dispute that counsel missed the deadline. She didn't try to hide that fact. I'm not suggesting she's a horrible attorney who didn't care about this case, but the fact is she missed the deadline, not by a couple of days, but by a couple of months.
Is it per se ineffective assistance of counsel to miss a deadline?
In this particular case, I would suggest to the court, absolutely it is. And the authority that I would cite for that would be People versus Valdez, 178 P3rd, 1269. That's a fairly recent 2007 case.
Is that cited in your briefs?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that cited again, counsel?
It is. I'm sorry, 178 P3rd 1269. And I do cite to that case in my answer, I'm sorry, in my reply brief. Essentially what that case was about, it was a 35C, not a 35B, where the court assigned the public defender's office to represent the defendant. They held the case for 7 years, never filed anything. And then the issue in that case was, there was really basically two issues. Number one, should the public defender have gone forward with it earlier, and was that per se ineffective? And number two, was the defendant's failure to do something in the meantime, did that constitute an abandonment of his claim? What's significant about that case, Valdez, is it specifically says that where counsel's performance negates an entire judicial proceeding, in that case, a 35C, in this case, a 35B, when counsel's conduct results in the entire proceeding not happening, that is ineffective assistance of counsel. When you have a proceeding, say he had gone forward with the 35B, the court had heard the merits and denied the merits, then we can say, yes, we can rely on that proceeding because the court considered the merits of the case. Here, Mr. Napier's case never even got to the merits, and you can't presume that is a reliable proceeding because it never took place.
But doesn't that issue go to the prejudice prong of ineffective assistance rather than whether it was ineffective as a matter of law? And doesn't that maybe relate to what the reasons were, if any, why the motion wasn't filed timely? And without an allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel, why would the court even go there in the first place?
It absolutely does go to the prejudice prong, and I would absolutely agree with the court's position there. In fact, that's part of the Strickland test. When you miss the entire proceeding, prejudice is going to be presumed. The other part is whether or not it falls below the standard of conduct. Here in this particular case, I think that it goes to both of them. One thing that I think is significant about the motion that counsel did file, first of all, she acknowledged that it was late. The second thing is she asked the court to look specifically at the issue of justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. Ineffective assistance of counsel can constitute justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. The district court in this particular case didn't make any findings on any type of excusable neglect. They simply said, it's timed out, we're not going to consider any of these issues, which is why precisely why we need factual findings from the district court, because they're in the best position to determine, was this a proper excuse? I think one of the things that perhaps the court may be concerned about is Swainson versus People is obviously probably the most on-point case before the court, 712 P2nd 479. Swainson specifically was a 35B case where the trial court dismissed it for being filed out of time. And then there was a pro se motion where the defendant said, hey, I thought my counsel was going to file this. My counsel didn't file it. I shouldn't lose my right because counsel was ineffective. Now, in that particular case, courts, both this court and the Supreme Court, they've declined to extend Swainson. Swainson is specifically for the extraordinary circumstance such as ineffective assistance of counsel. That is precisely what I'm alleging in this case, is that counsel was ineffective. This is precisely the type of extraordinary circumstance that Swainson is meant to redress through Rule of Procedure 45B2.
Couldn't you do that in a 35C proceeding at this point?
And Your Honor, quite simply, if this proceeding is denied, that would be Mr. Napier's next step, is to move to a 35C. However, before we get to that step, and quite simply, that's not a very good use of judicial economy, to dismiss this only to have something replace it to get to the very same issue.
Don't we assume that ineffective assistance of counsel would be proven at the 35C? When you say it's an inefficient use of resources, aren't you assuming that ineffective assistance of counsel would be established by the proof?
Absolutely. And I think it could be raised and proven in either proceeding. Swainson specifically provides a mechanism to address ineffective assistance of counsel in the context of a 35B specially extended by Rule of Procedure 42. I'm asking the court to use that procedure here in this particular case instead of starting over a new procedure that, as a practical matter, gets to the same exact result. It is not something that is going to unnecessarily extend Swainson or have it apply to a different situation, but that's precisely what is really being brought up here. And to sort of come back to what could Mr. Napier have done to make the situation different? He didn't just wait for his counsel to do this and then blame his counsel. In the meantime, he took steps on his own to make sure that things were going according to plan. Initially, he wanted to be accepted to the boot camp program. When he first found out that he was rejected, and to just sort of reiterate the timeline here, he was sentenced in June of 2007. In July of 2007, just a little over a month later, he found out that he'd been rejected from the boot camp program, which he'd been hoping would get him an automatic reconsideration. First thing he does is he writes a letter to Offender Services, the division of the Department of Corrections that makes these determinations. And he said, hey, can you please reconsider my case? What can I do to get this back before a reconsideration? So only a month later, he knew he was rejected from the program. I have no idea what his counsel was doing at that point, but the information was available, and for whatever reason, she didn't have it. He didn't act to abandon this claim. He basically kept pursuing the claim. One of the things that comes out often in appellate opinions is the idea that a defendant sort of abandons his right to pursue claims because he doesn't follow them up. In this case, he did exactly what he should have done to follow it up. He followed up within the time period a month later, and when he realized something was amiss, he knew his attorney had filed late. She didn't file until January, which is 3 months beyond the deadline. The day before the court actually issued a written ruling, which is March 7th, March 6th, the day before, he writes a letter to the district court and says, yes, I know there's a problem. There's this timing problem. Can you please consider my letter inquiring about this very issue that is well within the time range? Consider that to be my 35B. I'm not abandoning my rights.
Let's ask about that letter. As you said, it was directed to Offender Services. It didn't ask for reconsideration of a sentence. It asked for reconsideration of entry into the boot camp system.
And the court is absolutely right on that point. It did ask for reconsideration. I think that the point that's significant here is he's not abandoning the right to reconsider. Mm-hmm. He knows he has two avenues to do it, either through the boot camp program, in which he gets a statutory right to reconsider that's independent of 35B, or failing that, he knows he needs to follow it up. He knows he needs to follow it up for at least two reasons. First of all, he's obviously independently aware of it based on the letter that he wrote in March of 2008. The second reason is, at his sentencing, his own attorney said, I know he may not be accepted to the boot camp program. He has these health care issues. If that's the case, I intend to file a 35B motion with a delay ruling. He had every reason to believe that counsel would do precisely what she said he would do. He didn't abandon it. It's not like he waited till 2 years later and thought to himself, hey, my counsel didn't do what she said she wanted to. I want a reconsideration. He didn't let it go. In the Valdez case, which I referenced earlier, which was this 7-year lapse, one of the issues that came before the court is, yeah, he has a right, but did he abandon it because he wasn't pursuing it that whole time? That's exactly the opposite of what happened here. The appellate courts want defendants to pursue those rights by keeping them fresh. If something goes wrong, they need to respond. That is exactly what he did here, and that's exactly why I'm asking the court to remand this to the district court to make determinations on issues that he never waived and should be properly considered on their merits.
Counsel, if we don't agree with your position that there's per se prejudice, what evidence is there in the record that there is a reasonable probability that if the court had considered on the merits the motion to reduce sentence, it would have been granted?
And Your Honor, as far as the specific record, what's kind of significant to that specific issue is the attorney in this case, when she did file her 35B out of time, the first part about that talks about, yes, I filed it out of time. These are the reasons why I think I have excusable neglect. She then went on to lay out the grounds for which a 35B should be considered. She laid out his family situation, the fact that he has a supportive wife, a supportive father, he has a stable place in the community to come back to, that he has job prospects, all those things that are related to a 35B. In addition, it set out the efforts that he'd made to become enrolled in programs in the Department of Corrections to be in a position to better integrate in society. So those were laid out, and I believe they're preserved. The fact is, though, the court never got around to considering the merits that were before it. Your Honors, I would certainly urge the court to allow Mr. Napier to have the merits of his claim considered by the district court. I would ask for a remand, and I would reserve my last 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
You have about 2 minutes and 25 seconds.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Catherine Hansen appearing on behalf of the people in this matter, registration number 25464. Your Honors, the motion speaks for itself. There's just simply no allegations in the motion of ineffective assistance of counsel. In fact, counsel blames the DOC in the untimely notice of the second boot camp objection for the untimely filing. The defendant asked for a remand for findings, but we don't have a claim before it. So the people would ask that this court reject the defendant's request for a remand and simply uphold the trial court's finding that the motion was untimely.
The motion recounted how defense counsel had conveyed that she intended to file for reconsideration following the denial of his rejection from boot camp. Is that correct?
I don't believe there was anything in the motion where, well, first of all, there's nothing in the motion where the defendant had specifically asked for reconsideration, just a regular 35B.
No. Was there anything in the motion where the defense lawyer recalls at the sentencing hearing saying she intended to ask for reconsideration?
She may have said that in the motion. I don't recall. I don't have the motion before me, but I do have what she said at the sentencing hearing before me, where she said, if that doesn't happen, the boot camp, I will likely file for reconsideration. The thing is that boot camp reconsideration is a much different type of reconsideration. You have a preference in the law for reconsideration when someone's completed a boot camp program. It is certainly possible that in this case, the defendant knew and
she said she would apply if he did not complete
camp. She said, I will likely be filing a motion for reconsideration. That's what she said at sentencing.
If he doesn't make it into boot
Correct.
Camp.
But I think that statement certainly doesn't constitute ineffective assistance of counsel. What could have very likely happened is that he didn't get into boot camp twice, and they realized they didn't have grounds for reconsideration. The whole point of reconsideration is something, trying to convince the court beyond that which was presented at sentencing. You can present additional information. You can try and portray information in a different way.
She presents information in the motion itself.
I don't believe there was much in the motion that was different than was at sentencing. I think the point is that she said at sentencing.
Does it have to be different than what was presenting at sentencing?
No, but I could see why just choosing not to pursue a 35B motion would be sound strategic, or not strategic, but a sound decision if you basically have nothing new to add.
Counsel, let me ask you, what is, in your view, necessary in terms of language to preserve a ineffective assistance of counsel claim? Do you have to use those words, or if you didn't use those words, you have to cite Strickland, or is there something less than either of those that you have to do where the court would be on notice that, yep, I've got an ineffective assistance counsel argument in front of me?
I think the first thing you absolutely have to have is some sort of allegation that the defendant asked his attorney to file a motion. We don't have that here at any point. We do not have at any point, even in his letter, which was filed months after the defense counsel had acknowledged that the motion was untimely. We don't have any allegation that the defendant actually asked her to file a 35B motion. That's what we have in Swainson. So I think you have to have that, which we don't have. You also have to show that basically he asked and her late filing was deficient performance.
That it was her fault? That it was her fault for the late filing?
Yes. I mean, I believe that it's counsel. You have to show that her performance was deficient, so that she filed the motion late and it was because of her. So you have to show that he asked her to, because I think she's not faulted for not filing a timely motion if he never asked her to. And so that's critical to the deficient performance, which is not presumed. So you have to have an allegation that he asked to file. You have to have something in there which indicates that she received that request, she knew of that request, but it was deficient for her not to comply with that request to file a timely motion. All we have is her assertion that she didn't file the motion because she didn't receive the DOC notice of the rejection from boot camp a second time. It may be ineffective assistance of counsel here, but we don't know because we don't have any allegations of deficient performance. And so where we're at now is a trial court ruling that the motion was untimely. The defendant is asking for the first time on appeal for this court to consider a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel having been raised and asking to send it back to the trial court for factual findings, which obviously if this court disagrees with counsel, it has to be remanded because we have no factual assertions whatsoever. For all we know, the defendant just never asked, never wanted one. We don't even know that he specifically told her, no, let me just go the boot camp route because I won't win on 35B. We just don't know that.
Do you agree that the defendant could file a 35C?
Yes.
Specifically raising the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Yes, I believe she could. He could. And that's the proper avenue because at the 35C is where they can make the allegations and the trial court, if necessary, can consider those. The trial court needs to consider factual assertions, needs to make factual determinations. This court doesn't have any factual findings to review. And so a 35C would be the avenue. And I agree, that is another proceeding, but I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that it's ineffective assistance of counsel here. We don't know what happened.
He was sentenced here in 2007, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so there'd be no time bar problem, 16-5-402?
Not at this point, and I believe that the time bar, I'm not exactly sure, but I believe it would probably start after this proceeding is concluded. But I'm not 100% sure about that, but I believe it would start. But even at 2007, we're still well within the three-year time period.
Do the people contend that the defendant was not prejudiced by the late filing?
We don't know. We just don't know. I think Valdez recognizes that when you lose your right to a direct appeal due to ineffective assistance of counsel, they will presume prejudice and reinstate that right. I believe Swainson talks about if ineffective assistance of counsel is established, deficient performance, that they will reinstate the right to file at 35B. I don't recall any case law that says that you really do an analysis as to whether or not the motion would have been granted or not. So I think the issue here is deficient performance, and we just simply have no allegations. I'd be happy to answer any other questions that this court has. Otherwise, we would ask that you affirm the trial court's ruling. Thank you.
Counsel?
And if I may just briefly respond to a few issues here. I think probably most importantly is actual prejudice. He can't possibly have, one, a hearing that never took place. Whether or not there were grounds for 35B, whether it was good enough for reconsideration, of course we don't know that because the court never got to the merits. There's a lot of issue about what was and wasn't raised before the trial court, but counsel in this case unequivocally stated this in terms of justifiable excuse, excusable neglect. She knew she was out of time. She did not hide that from the court, and she asked the court to consider the reasons why she was out of time. Not only did the court not address the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, there's absolutely no finding as to justifiable excuse or excusable neglect.
Are you saying now that there's a additional ground for justifiable excuse or excusable neglect besides ineffective assistance of counsel?
Your Honor, ineffective assistance of counsel, I think, is the crux of the issue here. However, one thing that is set out in both my opening brief and my answer brief is the fact that there's no factual findings of any justifiable excuse or excusable neglect.
Are you saying there's justifiable excuse or excusable neglect independent of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Arguably, yes.
And arguably, yes. Was that what you presented in your opening brief?
What I presented in my opening brief is the fact that there was no factual findings made as to that issue. And I believe that the district court needs to make factual findings as to the justifiable excusable neglect presented by counsel, and in addition, to the reason cited by her, whatever paperwork she did or did not receive from the Department of Corrections. In addition to that, ineffective assistance of counsel, which is the late filing in and of itself.
Well, what law
seems a different emphasis here, counsel. I'm sorry, Judge, I interrupted.
I guess I would ask, what law is there in Colorado that would say in this procedural context there is any ground other than ineffective assistance of counsel that as a matter of law would provide excusable neglect?
Your Honor, in this case, I think that the ineffective assistance of counsel really is what forms justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. But the fact is that defense counsel in this case did set forth other grounds that the trial court did not make any rulings about other than the time period. And I certainly don't mean to shift the emphasis, but that was something else that...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Any other questions?
No, I'm done.
Thank you. Counsel, we thank you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.